This week on Basic Black, some would argue that since September 11th, it has never been more difficult to be a Muslim in America. The recent ISIS-inspired massacre in San Bernardino and the call for a ban on all Muslims entering the U.S. by presidential candidate Donald Trump has stirred biases and fears, and once again left Muslim communities at the center of a heated cultural and political climate. We'll delve into what it means to be a Muslim now using the Huntington Theater Company's latest production, Disgraced, as a jumping-off point for our discussion. That's our conversation coming up.
Our panel tonight, Philip Martin, senior reporter, WGBH News. Tahira Amatul Wadud, executive board member, Council on American Islamic Relations, Massachusetts. Callie Crossley, host Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, WGBH News. Sahara Salad, assistant professor of sociology, Simmons College. And Taimula Abdur Rahman, chaplain, Harvard University. To join the conversation, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
We're talking at a time when anti-Muslim sentiment is really at an all-time high, some of what people call Islamophobia, in fact. And right in the middle of these tense times, art imitating life. In a Pulitzer Prize winning play by Ayeed Akhtar, the playwright, who is himself Muslim, called Disgraced. It's running now at the Huntington Theater. And the essence of it is that Amir, who's the main character, has been a long time really downplaying his religion to make it in his corporate law firm. It all comes together in a dinner party with another couple when the discussion about race and religion, being Muslim, rises to the surface in a very intense discussion. And it was a way to kick off our discussion. Let's take a look at an excerpt from the play, Disgraced.
What's that like for you?
What?
With security at airports. No, what? You know, you hear stories.
Wouldn't know. I cut right to the chase.
He volunteers himself, goes right up to the agents and offers himself up.
What? To be searched?
I know they're looking at me. I figure why not make it easier for everyone involved?
I never heard anyone doing that before.
On top of people being more and more afraid of folks who look like me, we end up being resented too.
Those agents are working so hard not to discriminate. Then here's this guy. Comes right up to him and calls him out.
Pure unmitigated passive aggression, that's what my wife thinks.
Maybe she's got a point.
Well, I think it's kind of admirable, Amir. If everyone was so forthcoming, the world would be a very different place.
It's racial profiling.
Honey, I know what it is.
When somebody is suppressing or hiding some facet of themselves, there's a cost. And I think it's also something intrinsically Jory understands, or every one who is not part of the majority gets, that they're... Amir's example is perhaps, you know, pronounced, but I think everyone in this country who is not part of the majority, somewhere in their bones, understands what that is, that navigation of how much, you know, of what to present to be safe. And post 9/11, that's gotten very complicated for people who are in fact Muslim, people who have Muslim names, or people who are thought to be Muslim, but who aren't. And that's very much part of Amir's journey. And you know, the play takes several tragic turns, but his impetus to do this, I think, and I would hope that the audience sees, is certainly reasonable, certainly logical in the climate that we live in today.
So let's talk about that climate, because it's very much now, many people will say, well, maybe all Muslims are terrorists, and you know, that's just a plain fact, and I don't dispute that. And at a time, Tahira, when we have a presidential candidate saying that all Muslims, that's everybody in the group, ought to be stopped from coming into the country. You know, what impact does that have overall on the community of Muslims?
Donald Trump's comments, as horrible as they are, that Islamophobia has become very pervasive. I tell the story that my seven-year-old sat down on the bed before he went to school, and he said to me, he saw me looking at my phone, and he said, "Is that Donald Trump?" And I said, "Yes, how do you know?" And he said, "Because he doesn't even want me to stay in the country." And I said, "Well, where are you going? You were born here, I was born here." And he just said, "Well, he doesn't want Muslims in this country." And he looked very sad. And it made me realize that even though I try to shield my children from the hate, it is too pervasive for me to shield them all from it. And I think it also, his vocal comments have also emboldened people who may have secretly felt hatred towards mm-hmm. people, or maybe have been on the fence about that hatred. It has emboldened them to believe that it is okay. And so now everywhere we turn, we're seeing it. And it's harmful not only to the Muslims who are victims or people who are identified as Muslims, but it's harmful to their neighbors, their friends, and their families who are not Muslim. And it's a problem. It's a very serious problem, I think.
It's one thing to be dealing with this kind of aggressive, hate-filled actions. We've heard about attacks on mosques, women walking down the street with headscarves, all these kinds of things. But it's quite another, it seems to me, to have all Muslims equated with terrorists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sahar.
Yeah, so I think that is sort of the, you know, the big issue is that now to be a Muslim in America post 9/11, I think it's also important to recognize that this didn't just, you know, sort of come out of the blue. You know, even with 9/11, there were, you know, representations of Arabs and Muslims as if they were terrorists, and then 9/11 sort of confirmed it. But now we have, you know, in the years since 9/11, what we've seen is that, you know, it spiked after 9/11, but then it went down, but it's been continuously on the rise, these anti-Muslim sentiments. So to be Muslim in America when something like Paris happens, the attacks, or San Bernardino, coupled with Trump's rhetoric, the rhetoric that's going on right now, is that to be Muslim in America is to be suspect, essentially. It's to feel like you're suspect in your own country. Yeah.
Tamela, your job as chaplain at Harvard University is to bring people to a place of peace and mm-hmm. they, you know, celebrate, acknowledge their religion. How do you begin to have a conversation with folks who have in their mind that terrorism is now equated with Muslim?
Right. Well, it's funny. African novelist Chimamanda Adichie, she talks about the danger in the single narrative. And she says the single narrative creates stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the stereotypes is not that they're untrue, right? But that they're incomplete, right? It makes one story the only story. So for me, my job is to, you know, I have two, you know, it's twofold, it's two-pronged. The first is a pastoral care provider is to instill an identity of pride, right? And self-affirming qualities in the students who are tomorrow's leaders. But at the same time, you know, when I deal with people who may not understand, the first thing is I want them to understand for Muslims, it's more rewarding for us to be trusted than it is to be liked, right? So we're constantly working on how we can be civically engaged and politically aware and socially astute enough to be accepted. And we shouldn't have to do that, right? Because whatever's happening with ISIL or ISIS, we should call it what it is. They're homicidal maniacs that have nothing to do with the fold of Islam. And anyone who has any kind of sentiment or concern for history is aware of that.
What are you hearing as you're out and about doing your reporting, Philip?
I've been hearing, I mean, you look around the country right now and you see a pig's head being thrown into one mosque. You see armed right-wing vigilantes in Texas standing outside of a mosque with heavily armed. You're seeing a Somali cafe bombed in North Dakota. You see in Burlington a mosque that has been defaced. The problem is that there's a degree of normalizing of these acts of vandalism and terrorism. And the reason I say that is because these things have happened, and I've seen it over the last few weeks. You think about it, since Paris, even right before Paris, you've seen any number of acts that have occurred around the country, including, again, men arming themselves, places like Virginia, where there was a plot to bomb a mosque and to shoot black people and Muslims. And within that, with those incidents, you also hear an individual say, we need to keep Muslims out of the country. that the problems are Muslims, and you hear lots of cheers. That's normalizing. That is accepting a mainstream, you know, violence as acceptable. And the reason it's violent, the reason when you start to talk about keeping people out of a country and also handing them, making sure they register, don't forget that this particular politician I'm referring to, Mr. Trump, also initially suggested that Muslims be registered, there be a registry for Muslims. This, of course, obviously is akin to what occurred during
Nuremberg,
during the war. Right. That's right, in Germany and other places, and with colonialism. We also have to talk about British colonialism. They had systems of registration in places like Kenya, so on and so forth. And so the problem, again, is when lots of people, more than a few, cheer loudly and say that makes sense. That's when we have to step back and ask, you know, what is it that's happening in our nation where this type of division is accepted as normal? It's when a stereotype takes over reality. It pushes out any sense of reality. Verisimilitude becomes, you know, like the truth. It replaces justice, and it replaces constitutional guarantees.
So, but you know, but what do you do in this situation? So you can say, because it's really hard to defend against an untruth, as you know. I am not the red bull. You can say, so yes, you are. Okay, now where are we going? You know, I am not a terrorist. Yes, you are. You know, how do you? And defend maybe is not even the right word, but how do you push against that narrative? To Taymullah's point, there should be many stories told, but how do you do that?
I think we have to make the you know, the stories where we see your average American Muslim, you know, that isn't the terrorist, that doesn't have extreme views. I mean, that's the majority of the Muslims living in, American Muslims living in this country. And the other issue, I think, to your point, is that, you know, we have had, you know, this system, the national, you know, we had a registration system for mostly Muslim immigrants in this country after 9/11, where they had to register. It was called NSEERS, where they had to register and they were fingerprinted and interrogated. And there were, if you were from one of 25 countries, you had to do this, and you were male over 16, and 24 of those were Muslim. So, you know, we have these things that have been in place since 9/11, and I think that we need to be aware of that too, you know. So, and also to represent the normal American Muslim, which is the norm in this country.
Well, there's always to hear a complaints that we never hear from the moderate Muslims. We never hear from the folks that don't believe that in this terrorism, so they must secretly support, you know, what's being done in the name of Islam by people who are legitimately terrorists.
I think that's I know that position, and I think it's a hypocritical position for people to take. Islam is a religion of moderation, so we begin there. And you don't have to ask a group of people to answer to or apologize for a minority of folks who do things in the name of Islam when in fact they're not Islamic, they're not American at all, those behaviors. Those, we're talking about ISIS and other extremists. And in terms of how do we go about responding to this growing rhetoric, in addition to seeing people in public who are Muslim, who are living the American and the Islamic lifestyle, one of the things that I've been doing in Massachusetts and in New York is encouraging communities to reach out in an interfaith capacity. And that has been probably one of the single most effective forms of informing others about what's happening. Because yesterday I walked into a mosque and it was an interfaith program, and to see 200 folks sitting in that room, many of them Caucasian, many of them older, a lot of them from different churches and synagogues, that was reaffirming. And what I tell my children is that you hear this rhetoric, but it's coming from a very vocal minority. Mm-hmm. It is not the majority. People love you, those who look like you, those who don't look like you, your doctors, your neighbors, your teachers, whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim, they love you and they support you. And I think, and I don't know if it's just that I'm just optimistic, but I think the tide is actually turning on Islamophobia. Mm. Because now when you read the comment section, you see people thinking more critically about what is being written. And that's one of the other things, is that the average American has to think a little bit more critically about what's being written, what's being said, and challenge it. Don't sit back passively, but challenge it. Come to whatever conclusion you want to come to, but think critically about the position being fed to you.
Right. So that leads me to this, and that is when we start talking about Muslims, it's as though, you know, three of y'all, five of y'all got in the room and you're all alike. There are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. Right. And in that group are African Americans, South Asians, Arabs. So it's not a monolithic group. So to your point, many people, as a response to Donald Trump, initially said, well, who are you going to stop? It's not, you can't identify them in that way.
That's right.
And so you have to think about it. So let's talk about identity and how that may be shifting, changing, I don't know, in the community of Muslims now. How are you seeing that, Taimula?
Mm-hmm.
And in a minute, we're going to go to a clip from Disgrace. Let me just get your initial response.
Well, I think we can only attain universality through a particularity. So we have to acknowledge the beauty and uniqueness of a thing before we can make those universal connections. So again, I think what you're seeing, I think what the sister said is absolutely correct, is this new generation of Muslims, they're more assertive, right? They're not afraid to say their Muslim name. They're not afraid to wear the hijab or grow the beard out. And I think what's happening is you're seeing the opposite effect of what people wanted. This, it's not making people more fearful. It's fortifying their faith. And I think that another thing is that when you look at democracy itself, there's always been, even in democratic republics, there's always been a group that has to be marginalized and scapegoated at all times. And the beauty about democracy is that it works if you're accepted into that system, right? But then if you're not accepted into that system, then you're forced to stay on the sidelines as a spectator and watch the American dream drive right by you. So I think, you know, there's some hypocrisy in that, you know, democracy is supposed to be for all of us. But then at certain points and at certain times in history, we see how groups are taken out of democracy and marginalized for reasons that, you know, they can create any kind of reasons as they go.
Well, this is a natural connection to the next excerpt from the play Disgraced. Again, it's by Ayeed Akhtar, won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize. And the discussion about identity is one that we'll look at in this clip.
The next terrorist attack is probably going to come from some guy who more or less looks like me.
Well, I totally disagree. The next attack is coming from a white guy who has a gun he shouldn't have.
And pointing it at a guy who more or less looks like me.
Not necessarily.
If every person of Middle Eastern descent started doing what you're doing,
yeah.
I mean, if we all got used to that kind of compliance, we might actually start getting a little too comfortable about our suspicions.
So, you do have suspicions.
I mean, not me, I'm just saying.
I think that this play, incorporated with the current political environment, allows us to realize that this is one story, and that this story is not everybody's story. Similar to saying that a Muslim, because he has a beard or a kufi, is a terrorist. You know, you can't categorize people based off how they look, based off their religion, based off what they believe, because everybody's different. Everybody wants something. Everybody is striving for a good life. I inherently believe that. I think that, you know, this current political landscape is so, you know, there's peaks and there's troughs and there's so much hatred and grandstanding, and it's not beneficial to, you know, pushing this country forward. It's setting us back. It's holding us back.
So that's the part of that of his conversation. There is about external forces, but I'm interested in the internal discussion going on in Muslim communities, because we've just discussed there's a wide variety as people try to seek. As is demonstrated in the play Disgrace, trying to figure out, well, where is my identity and do I choose to embrace it fully, perhaps, or not? So let's talk about, because as I mentioned, it's worldwide, there's differences. In America, the difference between foreign-born and native-born Muslims, American Muslims, do you want to tackle that, Sahar?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think there are a lot of differences, and a lot of scholars have studied those differences. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, there was this book that came out right after 9/11, and she studied Muslims in New York. And what she found was that it was, you know, the immigrant Muslim parent was so fearful for their daughter who was wearing the hijab, you know, the headscarf after 9/11, that they would get in these arguments at home where the American-born daughter was like, no, I'm not going to take off the hijab, and I refuse to do, you know, to do that. And so I think that, you know, to your point about how, you know, once your identity is attacked and or marginalized, there's also a response, which is to embrace it even more. And so the Muslims who are born in the United States are recognizing that, you know, how the Muslim identity has become attacked or racialized since 9/11. And so you do see a difference somewhat between the way they respond and immigrant Muslims would respond.
Yeah. It seems to be, and you touched on it a little bit, there seems to be also overlapping that, the generational. Mm-hmm. So you've got both a difference between foreign-born and American-born Muslims, but then you also have some generational differences.
Right, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think that what you're finding is maybe 30, 40 years ago, the parents of the students I deal with, right, they had different issues. They were coming here to try to find an education, a career, and settle themselves. And I think this generation has time now because Islam has kind of been codified in America. They kind of have time to sit back and reflect and say, okay, where can I both be effective in my religion and socially? So you're finding a lot of young Muslims being involved in social justice issues, you know, dealing, making alliances with different groups in order to, you know, create a agency in those platforms. So I think that's important, is you're seeing some kind of bravery that you may not have seen 30 years ago by Muslims who just wanted to be quiet and get a job and, you know, stay in the back.
What I haven't seen, at least in a larger media sphere, is, if you will, more cooperation, visible cooperation between those African Americans. That's one kind of narrative for Muslims and Islam. And then there's the assimilation narrative, the individuals who have arrived to the United States and either embraced or have moved away from their religion. What I've mainly seen are people embracing, as you pointed out, their religion more and more these days. I'm mentioning that because I was just up in Lewiston, Maine, where you have a significant Somali community. And the most recent community are Bantu Somali, in working with those traditional or ethnic Somali who arrived in Lewiston in 2001. And there seems to be greater effort now than there certainly was before, because you have history and culture that have divided those communities dramatically. Mm-hmm. That's not always talked about, the division between Somalis. But there's also this recent entree, and that is the role of African Americans in that culture. I'm saying for the first time, I haven't seen in a long time, the assimilation narrative coming together, you know, with the African American narrative, and there seems to be greater cooperation, but you don't see it in the context of the media. That's not always shown. Mm-hmm. And so this rainbow that we talk about in context of Islam, it's sometimes obfuscated by an assumption. There seems sometimes to be an us and them, if you will, even right. within Islamic communities. And I think that maybe that is something that the greater Muslim community can address. Because I think that's important in order to talk about the normalization of Islam, and that, as a Pew poll recently showed, right. more and more people are, in fact, even though it's low numbers in relative to Christianity, but there are fewer...
Christianity's dropped by 8%, according to the Pew.
Dropped by 8%, that's right. And the Islamic population or growth is gone up. Mm-hmm. And a part of that, a lot of that is attributable to African Americans. I don't think I've gone to a family reunion in years where I didn't see a new member of my family, someone who I had not met before, now you see Christians, you see Muslims at my family reunion. And that's true of African-American family reunions, I think, all over the country these days.
Well, you left us with a lot to unpack. Let me just let people know that we're going to be going online shortly where we have to discuss gender, and I know you want to hear that conversation within this conversation. But let me just pull out one of the first things you said about, you know, the image of who a Muslim is. Mm. And is it that there is one kind of image, even though we've just discussed there's a wide variety in the community put forth as this is this is who we mean when we say Muslim. Tahira.
I think to bigots, they don't care. Yeah. Right. They don't care to analyze Somali from African-American to South Asian. They don't care. Mm-hmm. So they're just going to hate you because they think that you believe in this religion. And with respect to the African-American, the role of the African-American Muslim, I think that's very interesting because what I've seen anecdotally is I see African-Americans maybe taking a little bit of a leadership role with respect to answering to Islamophobia. And African-Americans have a privilege, I want to say, with respect to having been told over many generations, this country was built on the backs of your ancestors. And so we can join with our foreign-born brothers and sisters and whose ancestors were foreign-born and say, we got this, but we have it together.
What's your take on tonight's discussion? Share your thoughts by following us on Twitter and Facebook. For previous episodes of Basic Black, download our podcast available on iTunes.
Regional, but I have friends across the country in this fight, and I think that it is happening across the country, and I hope that it will continue to happen into 2016.
What do you say about that, Sahar?
Yeah, I think that there's an opportunity right now, for sure, for this coalition building, particularly, you know, the Muslims who have, you know, come here and tried to assimilate into, you know, white neighborhoods, white schools, but you've had African-American Muslims here for a very long time. And I really hope that there is this opportunity, especially with what's going on right now and how, you know, horrific the comments are about Muslims, really recognizing that they need to form these coalitions.
And then there's so much common ground. You think about relationships between police and Muslims and then...